Hi, I'm Sean Reynolds.
And I'm Rachel Reynolds.
And welcome to What Was I Made For?
The podcast about doing what you love and prioritising your happiness.
While we aim to inspire, motivate and entertain you, please note that we're not licensed therapists or certified experts.
So if you're considering major life decisions like starting a llama farm or quitting your job to become a professional skydiving instructor, maybe get a second opinion.
Enjoy the show.
See, I just do what I want, do what I love. I don't want to stop, don't want to grow up. Just me being me, don't follow the crowd. Don't be a sheep, look at me now. But now it's time to make more, create more. Looking at the points, cause it's time to take score. Feeling like I'm grown now that I can face more. Got one question, what was I made for?
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Happy Wednesday.
Yep.
Yeah. Who's today's guest, Rach?
Samantha Lane.
And who is Samantha Lane, Rach?
Oh, she's so lovely. No, Samantha Lane is...
No,
she is. She's been in my life a long, long time. She was my dance teacher who ended up basically handing over her dance school to me, which then became Rachel Reynolds. So she has been a very big part of my life. Big part of my professional career, and it was so nice. I thought I knew pretty much everything about her until we then sat down, did this podcast, and I found out loads more. And she's got some great stories. If you're a Starlight Express fan, there are some great stories about that.
Strap in. And just a little trigger warning on this episode, guys. If you've got young ears listening, please give it a listen first and see if it could be triggering to them. Sam does go into detail about the struggle she had becoming a dancer as a young person. So just maybe give it a listen before you show any impressionable ears. Equally, if you have history with body dysmorphia or eating disorders, please bear that in mind before listening to this episode. So going off that, she is an actress, dancer. Well, I'd say she's your old school triple threat.
She's a mother, so she's got two grown-up children who are also going into the arts. So that's a great perspective for any parents listening.
Yeah, she has some interesting stuff for parents that who started their career, paused to have kids, and are thinking about potentially going back into their chosen industry. So listen up for some great insight into how Sam did that.
Yeah. It was great. It was lovely to sit down and chat with her and hear her story.
Enjoy the episode.
Bye.
Sam Lane, let's go.
So, Sam, we've got like a little bit of a loose structure that we're going to ask you like three main questions, basically.
Right. Well, no, the first question was, what was your drink of choice today, Sam?
Oh, yeah. It's actually an apple and pear herbal tea.
Which I feel like we kind of forced that upon you. You did want a green tea, but we thought, well, no, we'll just put some apples and pears in
this.
No, that's
fine. I mean, to be honest herbal. With you, they all taste the same. It just smells good. It's always the way.
No, that's good. That's a very healthy choice.
Yeah, I do. I don't drink a lot of caffeine, to be honest, but...
I've just had literally 2 pints of tea, so
yes,
I'm on the caffeine today. The first question we like to ask is, thinking back, what did young Samantha Lane want to be? Do you remember your first dreams of what you wanted to do when you were younger?
A dancer.
Really?
How old were you when
I love it when people say that's exactly what it
because I'm 2.5, yeah. And that's when I went to my first ballet class. And I think my mum thought at some point, this is going to stop. And it never did.
Wow.
Yeah. That is crazy. I didn't know if you were going to say that or not.
Yeah. So we lived in Norfolk and then we moved to Windsor. And I vividly remember the hall that my mum took me to on that first day. And I was 2. And I think we wore tutus in the class. It was a bit weird. But I remember thinking, oh, I feel a bit... Actually, I can't have remembered it then. I must have been a bit older. But I remember thinking, I feel a bit uncomfortable around people that I don't know. So actually, I think I must have gone to dancing when we lived in Norfolk. And then when we moved to Windsor, I must have been a bit older. And that's when Mum took me to that dance school in Windsor. But I went there for a long time. I did... exams, and then we found this ballet teacher in Eton, because Windsor and Eton quite close, and I remember her taking me there, and I'd just been going up through the ranks. I'd never done anything other than ballet, and I remember Susan Handy, who was my teacher until I was like 16 and went to college, she was an incredible dancer, incredible woman. And she, I went to that first lesson, she said, you need to be in a much higher grade than you are. I think the thing is, when you're a kid and you go to dancing, I had no awareness if I was any good or not. Mm-hmm. I was just going because it was something that I loved and it was an after school thing and I enjoyed being out of the house in the evening. And my mum just took me to all these classes and then it sort of snowballed. And so then she saw something in me. That was the first time really that I remember somebody going, actually, she's very good. I was always quite a strong dancer. I had quite a strong physique for a child. Like we were talking about it the other day. I think my two children are similar. I've been around my friends' kids where if one of them fell over, you'd pick them up when they were little and they'd be like a feather.
Yeah.
We're like concrete balls.
You just hit the deck.
I'm the same. I'm really like, you know, dense bone, quite muscly. Sorry to say it, but I think my kids are as well.
I've got a head in hands.
But I think, and so I think that came out as a dancer. I think I was a strong dancer, and I think it held me in good stead, actually, because I never really got injured. You know, I just kept going from there.
It's really funny that your dad says that about you. When you were younger, you were like a little muscle man.
Yeah, do you know the Michelin man, the tyre person? Yeah. Apparently, that's what I look like.
She used to strut down the beach like little Michelin man.
Yeah, and I never cried. Like I'd be the kid that falls over, bangs their heads, and like, oh, I'm back up again. Here I go. Like, really? Yeah. I don't know why. Maybe it's because my sister's quite like emotional. So
same.
So I was just like, nah, I'm good.
Getting on
I'm
with
good,
it.
Mate. I'll carry on.
Crack on. Yeah.
I'm a crier.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
If I was down, I was like, someone help me! I'm dying.
There's always one. Yeah. But no, I always just kind of got on with it, I think. But so from then, the opportunity came up. There were a couple of us taken from our ballet school to audition for the Royal Ballet. And I was 10 at the time, and you are a junior associate, so it's before you go to White Lodge. It's just a year. And I remember going up to London. I remember it was a really big deal. I was really nervous. We all had our number. I can remember my number was 511, which added up to 7, which is my lucky number.
Oh, nice.
I remember thinking, being really out of my depth. I'd never done anything like it before. And there were about 700 kids there, and they took 5 of us. And that was the time for me that I went, maybe... All I cared about was actually the McDonald's that we went for afterwards. Yeah, yeah. The fact that I got a chocolate milkshake because the McDonald's was new and it had just come out and I was so hungry. Yeah. And it was my dad was like, I'm going to take you to this place and we're going to have a burger.
You said you were 10 years old at this point?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, so then I went there for a year. My dance school used to get this information. It was an opportunity for any girls that they felt were, or boys, we didn't have any boys in our dance school at the time, that they felt would benefit from these amazing teachers. So we had Sir Anton Dolin, who is no longer with us, Beryl Gray. They were all really big ballet dancers. Mm. And we did basically like a week's worth of classes with these different amazing teachers. I mean, I think it cost quite a lot of money. Mm. My mum and dad didn't have a lot of money, you know, so they'd already put quite a lot on the line for me at that point. But I absolutely... felt very out of my depth. But so the Royal Ballet School thing, and then one other thing that happened while I was on that week away was that Beryl Gray, I remember the steps, I remember what we did across the room. We did a Grand Allegro, which is like a big jumpy thing. Mm. And that's what I was quite good at, because I always jumped quite well. They used to say I could do all the boys' stuff, because I think you got to have fat feet to be able to jump high.
But if you were a runner really as well, feet. Though, like, it gives you strong legs. And
I was quite good at bouncing, I suppose. Yeah. And she just said, she stopped the class and she went, I want you to do it on your own. Which was, I was a bit like, oh God, hideous. But she said to me that my timing was good. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what she was trying to teach to the other class. the timing of doing that Grand Allegro. And it was those two things that happened to me that year that made me think, maybe I could possibly do this. Mm. I didn't get into the White Lodge. So that's the senior school after you go to the junior associates. But they have a very weird way of, they don't really audition you when you go to the White Lodge. They do an X-ray of your wrist. Have I ever told you this?
No.
So in order to become a proper ballerina to go to the White Lodge and then train to go into like a corps de ballet or the festival or royal as a dancer, you have to have exactly the right physique. And in order to tell what your physique's going to be like, we all had to have an X-ray done of your wrist. And from the gap in the bones in your wrist, they can tell you your height and your stature. I didn't get into the White Lodge, which I was fine about because I didn't want to leave home. I was really goofy as well. So I used to suck my thumbs. I had teeth that were like out here. I remember going downstairs and saying to my mom, I really don't want to go to the White Lodge. I don't want to leave home. She was like, well, let's just wait and see. You might not get in. You know, I was like, yeah, I probably won't get in. I remember just being like braces and, you know, really kind of ugly stage. And I didn't get in because they said to me, you're going to be 5'3½", which I am, and you're going to be of athletic build, meaning you're going to grow really big boobs and dancers don't have those. And they were exactly right. They took one girl out of our whole year called Madeline, who had exactly the right physique. And she had the least experience as a dancer of all of us, but she had exactly what was needed to take her into the next stage.
Is that still the same today?
I think they do that.
Ballet dancers still have that.
I don't think they do it with an X-ray. I think they do it with, because I've spoken to people that, I know people who have children that are at junior associate now, and they do it with measurements more, but it is the same that you don't get to go onto the White Lodge.
So it's still a thing now that you have to have the right physique.
Is that because they want everyone to look uniform on stage, or is that because certain physiques perform ballet better?
I think it's a lot of things. I think aesthetically, as a dancer, if you're up on point and you have they don't want you to be too high. I think there is a uniform thing for the corps de ballet, which is the group. I don't want to speak out of turn because I don't know if things are changing. I've just watched a documentary on it, actually, a Panorama documentary, which was very interesting.
I watched it. Sam texted me and went, you put it on your story and I watched it. It was shocking. That's quite a well-known thing, but I'm really hoping as a dance teacher that we are going in the right direction.
Yeah, you are.
For some...
It's changing.
Yeah, but ballet is totally different though, isn't it?
But like, I think that's what this documentary was bringing to the forefront, that actually something does have to change,
right?
Because ballet dancers are athletes. Mm. What is expected from their bodies, and you're doing a lot of it on, it was called the Dark Side of Ballet Schools.
Because when you watch films like Black Swan and all those ones, they show ballet as being like brutal.
It is.
So it actually is.
Oh my God, my feet, you know, if your feet aren't bleeding really, if you imagine what you're spending your life training to get up on point, which is not a natural thing to do, is it? And then to be able to fuel your body and to be able to deal with that amount of exercise on a daily basis is a challenge before you've done anything. But I do think that my ballet training, which was all I did up until the age of 16, I never did anything else, was the thing that held me in good stead as a dancer. Mm. When I first did my first jazz class, I was not a great tapper, but when I first did all that other stuff, I was like, oh my God, this is like the best thing I've ever done. Why haven't I done this before? But I just didn't have any access to it. I didn't know anybody that did that kind of dancing.
Yeah. So then you did just do ballet.
That was it.
Wow.
You must have felt so free when you've tried all those other styles.
I was like, this was what I was made for. And I think part of it was that it goes back to, and that's why I mentioned it, the timing thing. Like, my cousin is a drummer in LA for, like, not Nirvana, Eminem, He's on tour with Frankie Valli at the moment.
Amazing.
Brilliant drummer. And I think there is something in our family. Mm-hmm. We have a bit of a musical side. We're all a bit
creative.
And I think timing and music, does move you, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
The school that you went to, I don't know if you want to mention what it's called, because I know there was some dark sides of that too, and it is still going.
Yeah.
Was that the only place you applied to?
It was at the time, because it was quite near where I lived, and I was at college for 3 years, so I went at 16, which I consider to be really young. Nowadays, you can't go until you're 18, and I think that's better, because I think you're still very much a child, and I think it's quite a full-on, it's like you learn very quickly how strong you have to be. I had this one teacher that everybody wanted to be in her class, and I'd gone to her actually from the age of 12 as a semi-student when we moved to this area. So she knew me a little bit before I went as 16. She would use me in her numbers, which was incredible, because not a lot of people got the opportunity to be in those numbers. I remember actually in the third year, I was left out and I was mortified. Like, I cried for weeks because she didn't want to use me.
Why though?
We never knew why. It was
just weren't in the cut that year.
No. Which is difficult when you've been in previous years and then you're like, have I done something wrong? But I was told in some fairly brutal ways throughout those 3 years that I was too fat on a consistent, and those were the words used.
That is shocking.
I mean, we would have classes and someone would bring in weighing scales.
Stop.
And we'd be about to start the class in our lines and there would be a couple of questions. Hands up if you have gravy on your roast dinners. And I was living at home, so my hand would go up. Hands up if you have sugar in your tea. My hand would go up. Hands up if, I mean, ridiculous questions. So then she would go, you, and you, come and stand on this scale. And then she would read out your weight in front of the other girls.
That is hadn't disgusting. Been
I mean, fair play to you for just owning up to it, though.
Well, I mean,
who has gravy?
I'm not
who has sugar in a tea? Yeah,
like,
me too,
you know, I'm living at home. I'm like living my best life. I've got like...
Surely most people in that situation would be like, I'm not putting my...
Yeah, no, I mean, anyone. People probably lied, but
you're
I
like,
just...
You're like, love the stuff.
I would always be like...
just get it on me taters.
10 sugar in my coffee.
awful, though. Surely they don't... That can't be a thing anymore.
Oh, no, it can't happen now. Right. It wouldn't happen now, but I have often wondered that probably if it wasn't so much of a struggle because I was told constantly that I didn't look right, I probably might not have had the same drive if it had gone swimmingly for me, because I had something to prove when I left that college. I was not going to be somebody that was going to leave and be overlooked.
Starlight.
Yeah.
So you've never been on skates.
So I used to go to Leatherhead Leisure Centre on a Sunday, and that was our thing when we were teenagers, and we used to flirt with all the boys, and that was my sort of, I guess, before you can go to a club or a bar, that was our
Leatherhead
thing.
Leisure Centre. That's where it was at.
I used to love that day, you know. That was like, I don't know how long the session was, but it was brilliant. I used to love it. And I could skate, you know, fairly well. But so when it, two things happened. So on my 18th birthday, I don't think I'd ever seen a West End show. And I went to see Cats and Starlight in the same week. I saw Cats first and then I saw Starlight and thought they were both amazing. But when I saw those girls come out in Starlight, like in the very first time they went on stage, you used to be able to pay £2.50 and stand at the back and watch, stand up and watch the show for £2.50.
On the stage?
So they had the, where the track went round, you used to be able to just stand overlooking the track. For standing ticket was £2.50. So I ended up going like a ton of times because it was accessible and cheap and it's in Victoria, you didn't have to go. But the minute I saw those girls come out, I went, I'm going to be in this one day. Not ever believing that I would, really, but So when
that was like a dream role, sort of thing.
I just loved the choreography. I loved the costume. It was like, at the time, Arlene Phillips had had a dance group that went from like, so Top of the Pops had Pan's People, and then they went to some other group, and then it became Hot Gossip, which was quite like risque dancing. It was like the girls on the Kenny Everett show that were wearing next to nothing. It was quite provocative and probably wouldn't be allowed now, to be honest. But that choreography was the choreography basically that was in Starlight, but it was all pared down a bit. And obviously it was on roller skates, and it just had a feel about it that I just, it captivated me, and I just loved it. I loved the score. I loved how the girls were. I just wanted to be one of those girls. And then I left college at 19, and there was a, we didn't really have anything like socials or online at the time. We used to get a paper called The Stage, which had open auditions in it. And then, and there was an advert for an open audition for Starlight. And so I took my little bright blue canvas roller skates with yellow wheels. And I remember queuing up with everyone again. You got the number. Back in the day when they auditioned, it was not the format that they used to use as the years went on, and they used to want to make it more accessible to musical theatre people. So you would get people that were plumbers and carpenters and stuntmen. And what they made us do, I cannot believe I did it in an audition, because you were straight away, put your skates on. They would make you do a bit of the choreography from the show, which was really hard. I remember it was on the stage at the Apollo Victoria, which for anybody that went to see that,
is
it
that where
was,
Wicked is now?
Yeah, they had a thing called the paddock, which was a track that went down and around, and a load of really expensive tickets were in the middle of that, the paddock. That was the best place to sit because you were right on top of the action. And then there were people sitting around the outside of that as well. And I remember each group that they did the choreography with, before you kept getting like people were chucked out, they'd go, okay, first group do the choreography on the stage, and then they go, okay, and you guys go and sit down there and let's have the second group. And the paddock track was on the tiniest little hill, and I remember thinking, how do I get down there? I'm on my roller skates, like,
yeah,
myself, because I'd never really done anything. I'd only ever done stuff on the flat, and remember just thinking, how am I even going to get down to sit down there in a group?
Yeah.
I feel like we didn't have recalls. I feel like they pretty much decided, or maybe we came back the same week and they asked us to sing two songs, and I remember my song, so I sang Maybe This Time, and then they asked for a pop song and I sang Madonna. Literally on the piano, it was like a plinky plonky. I've had a plinky plonky plinky. And I remember at the end when I got the job, the MD said to me, "Don't ever sing that song in audition again." He was like, "It's not good. Like, don't do it." And I was like, "Oh, okay."
So you must have got through on your skating ability then, because if you had terrible song.
I think Maybe This Time is a theatre song, and I think they could hear my range from that. And but I still didn't know how well I'd done. And then the next thing I knew, we were all being told to arrive at a studio. They got us to put our skates on, and we were skating round and round, and they were sort of making us sort of go faster and faster and really trying to see how they could push us on skates. And then they said, OK, everybody sit down. You're going to be our cast.
Wow.
Oh my God.
Because it was huge. It was big.
What
it was
a moment,
like, we
though.
Didn't know that they were going to say that on that day. We just thought we were going for another skate lesson. And then they were like, you're going to be in the cast. I remember just thinking, what?
How did everyone react?
Emotional? No one was emotional. I wasn't emotional then. I was just like, it's because I'm old. But I think. You just think to yourself, so I remember I was cast as, which I know now, I didn't know until afterwards, but they told me that they actually wanted me for another part, but I wasn't a good enough skater. So I got the part that I got, which was Wrench, which was, out of all the female parts, probably the most unglamorous. It wasn't that nobody wanted to be it. She was part of Elektra's gang and she was a strong, which kind of goes mm-hmm. back to, I get why they cast me as it. That was my part. And I had three understudies, three of the main girls. So I understudied Pearl, Ashley and Dinah. And I used to take home £212 a week.
Wow.
Mm,
for how many shows?
8 shows a week, yeah. You'd have all your understudy rehearsals. And so if people weren't off, and you can imagine, Starlight was full of injuries because it was a very dangerous show.
Yeah, how often did people fall?
Yeah, was there anything catastrophic that happened?
All the time. The three Rockies, they had a number on stage. They were like gorgeous athletic men that did this incredible number, a rap number, dancing on stage, and like the, you know, obviously you've got your head mic on and the guy's ACL snaps mid song and you hear the scream, and all of a sudden they have to just, there's no way you can get him. There was no curtain in Starlight. The stage was always open, so they never brought anything in and would just go, okay, we can't. They'd just go, stop the show, and they'd literally,
he was singing at the time.
Yeah.
That is brutal.
And then it just, and you heard him scream over the mic, and then obviously he's in agony with the whole 1,500 people watching him.
Horrific.
Until they can stretcher him off. But I mean, that happened. That was an injury that happened, you know, more than once.
It's expected though, isn't it? When you're doing that much stuff on skates, and
I'll never forget
happen.
One of the worst ones that ever happened to me. But I mean, you know, we raced up and down. There were four races a show. They were fast. Some people got up to like just under 30 miles an hour on their skates. It was a very difficult, windy, tight set that you had to learn how to do. We spent actually not that long, 6 weeks in rehearsals, learning all the choreography and to skate the set. On the opening night, I remember I came off the bowl, which is a bowl that you would see, you know, when you see skateboarders.
Yeah.
But you'd go into that at speed. I've got my family in the audience. I hit it at the wrong angle and there was a pole at the end of it. I remember thinking, I'm not going to fall off. I'm not going to hit the deck on my opening night. I remember just like gripping onto it. And I mean, I was all over the shop because you're so anxious when your nerves hit you and you're on roller skates. Your legs are like jelly. So
it's bad enough when your legs are like jelly when you're not on roller skates.
So I actually can't believe it's lasted so long.
No, well, it did. You see, that is why any version that happens now never has a set like that. Because,
oh, really?
Yeah, because for...
probably can't get the insurance for it.
Health and safety. Yeah. It got to the point when we were getting towards the end of the show that health and safety was really kicking in.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it was a theatre on like four or five levels it had. All the boys, you know, that were incredible skaters would put their skates on floor 5 where they got ready, and then they just go down the stairs like that on their skates. Like, they were such brilliant skaters. Like, and there was a lift, but they would just never wait for the lift. But we got to the point where they wouldn't let us take our skates up. The skates had to be put in lockers. It became very tricky, really, to maintain a show like that because there were accidents happening all the time. When I was a component, which we started Act 2 coming round that bowl in a train of 7 of us, sometimes if CB was in there.
So holding on to
each other's belts. So you'd all have to know how to absorb the two lumps going into that to get the speed and the line. And imagine when you've just learnt what you're doing, nobody really knew what they were doing. You learn what you're doing the 8 shows a week.
And surely the theatre is different when it's full. You could learn as much as you want when it's empty.
Yeah, but when you've got people there, you know, and they've paid good money to watch. Mm. And there was the paddock that I was talking about that sat the really expensive tickets. The only thing they had sort of preventing them, the audience, from anything was we used to call, they were chicken baskets. So that it was like two flaps that came down that were made out of a tight, thick, I don't know what you'd use
like
it for, like for climbing mesh or something. And it made like a crisscross thing. And we used to call it the chicken baskets because if any one of us fell off stage, we'd end up chicken in a basket. And we all came round in that train and every single one of us, he hit the wrong line and we all came off and all of us ended up chicken in a basket in front of those people. Some of the girls were really injured on our train. And obviously you imagine then trying to get out of the chicken in the basket, your legs go down the holes. So then you're trying to climb out and the music's carrying on. That they don't stop. So you've then got to try and all get up out of there
and find where you're supposed to be.
Meant to hit off, and all sorts of things happen. Malfunctions with the set. So the barriers would shut and you'd just be coming down like a really steep slope and we'd all go over the top. One day they had a problem with their sewerage in the theatre. We were all skating through. I mean, literally. And water and wheels don't
go. How many years were you doing the show for?
I did two blocks of 4 years.
So that's what I mean.
Wow,
so all,
I didn't know it was that long.
So all these things happened over the course of 8 years. So although it sounds like an absolute show right now, that happened over a long period of time.
Yeah, but it happened regularly. So during a week of 8 shows, you were lucky. We used to say this all the time. If a show went well with no falls or no crashes or, you know, nothing going wrong with the set, the audience didn't really ever get how hard it was.
Mm.
Because if you were playing Pearl, you've just done half an hour on stage of full-on choreography, then everybody leaves and you're there singing a solo and dancing and spinning after half an hour. I mean, it was the hardest thing I've ever, ever done. And the shows that I did after that, in comparison to that, I think if... it was the best grounding for anything, because anything that came after that just seemed like, you know, easy.
A breeze.
Yeah. I think that is such an achievement. Like, I think to be able to, anyone who can say they made it into the West End, it is huge, especially if you're in this line of work. That is like the ultimate goal for so many people. But to say you've done a show like that, it's like so much more.
It doesn't exist anymore though, right?
In
the West End.
There's a specific theatre in Bochum in Germany that has been built just for Starlight, and that has been going for 35 years.
Is that similar to the original production?
Really similar. They have just had a revamp, so they've just changed it up a bit. But it's just coming back into the Troubadour, it's a very different version of the show.
You're going to go see it?
I do want to see it, yeah. I think all of us that were in it, I think we'll all be interested to go.
One thing I think a lot of people will find inspiring some friends of mine who I trained with who know a little bit about your story and no pressure, but hold a lot of faith in the fact that you did take a break to have your family.
Yeah. Pretty lengthy break.
Yeah. And I've even spoken to people about it who go, like the fact that Sam actually took 10 years, right?
No, 17 and a half years.
What?
I was going to say, it is a lot longer than that, right?
I did little bits. Thinking, I kept my hand in with little bits. But when I decided that I wanted to go back into a show, it was 17 and a half years before I managed to do that.
And then the fact that you did go, okay, like grown up children now, I'm going to go back in, and you succeeded is like so inspiring.
The thing about me is that I have to be completely honest about this, that yes, I did the audition process and I wouldn't have got that job, but I did have people that I knew that were doing that show that had asked me to go. So
they were in your corner already.
And that possibly helped. Yeah. But I think all my auditions, all my readings and all my singing stuff, you know, the songs that I did to get into that show had to go past a certain amount of people, including Paul Whitehouse, who co-wrote the show.
And we're talking about Only Fools and Horses.
Only Fools and Horses. So I think unless... he wouldn't have booked me, I don't think, if he didn't think I could do it, I suppose. So, that was my in, and I was dance captain again on that show. I absolutely loved it, and I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to do it. I've got to be honest and say that the journey just before being able to audition for that, like I had to go into therapy to try and become confident enough, because I couldn't even speak to the next door neighbour about schools that she wanted to choose for her children because I thought I'd said the wrong thing and I would get really anxious about it. So I thought, how am I ever even going to step foot in an audition room?
You just had like a lack of confidence or?
Total lack of confidence.
Really?
Like,
and that came from what? Just
being at home,
being a mum
for
that long. Yeah.
You know, and I think it is, I mean, people are speaking about it a lot more now, but I think it is normal to feel like that. It's really normal. And I think it takes quite a lot because it is like being in a bubble. You know, you become secure. Your daily life is all about thinking about other people. And so you put yourself on the back burner. And it was just the one thing that I just wanted to challenge myself and make myself, put myself in an uncomfortable position again, even if I didn't get a job at the end of it. And the way it came about really was that I remember I just picked our dog up at the time. It just had a procedure where I had to pick him up at the vet. And then I just got like this message through saying the person that I wanted to play Marlene in the workshop can't make the dates. Would you be interested in doing it? And it was that moment where I thought, and I had no clue what was going to be expected of me. Had I have known that I would be performing in an intimate space in front of a bunch of well-respected people in the industry to try and get this show on, and I had to do a full scene and a song, there's no way in a million years I would have said yes. But because I didn't know what it entailed, I just literally remember hesitating and finding the word yes came out of my mouth. And then I don't think I spoke for like 3 weeks until I had to go into that environment. And then when I did the workshop, which was 2 weeks, remember it was over April in 2018, we would get to lunch and it was with a bunch of people that had been in our industry, you know, for a long time. And I would leave there and I would phone my best friend in tears and go, I don't want to go back after lunch. I can't do it. I can't do it. I just want to be at home cooking fish fingers. And she was like, get your ass back in there. You are doing it. I was just petrified. I just found it. And I would go back in and pretend that I was okay and just got through the 2 weeks. And when I got offered the job, like, I remember the director saying to me, you know, what would you do? What would interest you? And I was like, literally, I would be like third orange seller from the left if it meant that I could...
You get back on the stage.
Get back on the stage, yeah. And then she was like, okay, well, you know, we're going to offer it to you. And so it was brilliant. It was great. I mean, it was a bit challenging because obviously we dealt with COVID in the middle of it.
And you said how coming from some more traditional shows, the difference in like the audience for a show like that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously when you put something on stage like Only Fools and Horses, you get a bunch of people that have watched the show and not necessarily been to the theatre a lot. But
well,
I mean,
it's got a huge following, isn't it?
Massive following. Yeah. And the way it was written was so brilliant because it was written by Jim Sullivan, who is John Sullivan, who wrote the TV series Son with Paul Whitehouse. Wow. So it was most of the material was taken from the Christmas specials. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it involved all the things that you would
hope
that you would see from the series. And I won't say too much because I know it's going on tour again for anybody that wants to see it at the end of this year. But so it had all of the best bits in it, really. Mm. And it was so funny. I mean, even after being in it and listening and you knew what was coming next and you know, done it for a year, I still found it funny. I still found scenes funny when I watched them side of stage. I thought it was a brilliant show.
Yeah, we saw it three times.
I mean, there was stuff that went, you know, that stage was a revolve. It was on a revolve. I mean, I had times where I tripped over and ended up going round on the revolve and I was crawling so that the audience didn't see my legs crawling back on. But as you're going round, if you trip up, you can imagine it's like a roundabout and you're just about to show your ass and your legs coming round and you're like, oh my God, get me off. Get me off this thing. I mean, you know, we stacked it all the time. I had an absolute blast on that show. Probably my best time was doing some of the Only Fools shows, I think, was so, just because of the content. And Paul Whitehouse is the funniest man you'll ever meet on and off stage, you know, and such a lovely, lovely person.
Yeah.
And that really held us all together, you know, because you want to do your best for someone like that. And I hope we all did, you know, but it was really good fun.
What do you think you were made for?
Oh, God. I mean, you know, I've always said, which is probably not very PC, but I'm a blonde dancer. I've never been able to do anything else. I'm certainly not good as a businesswoman because I didn't bring that school to any other fruition than passing it over to you, and you've done the most amazing job with it. Like, so proud. But that wasn't it for me. I never really said I wanted to teach, even though part of my job really has been a lot of teaching. I think I can't imagine that I would be any good at anything else. I think that is what I was made to do. That is the only thing I know how to do. Mm. And it just seems very normal. And yeah. I know it's probably not a job that people would think of as normal, but to me, that is what I do.
Mm-hmm. I think it's incredible that you wanted to do it from like almost a toddler.
Yeah, I was determined. Yeah, that was all I ever had in my mind, and it was from my earliest thoughts.
Mm. How do you feel now that Molly and Joe both want to pursue careers in that? Do you think? I mean, I don't know if they would believe this. It must have a lot to do with what you have showed them.
Yeah, I mean, I think being around people growing up, because, you know, my husband works for a sound company, Autograph Sound, that deal with a lot of the West End shows, and they do various things within the sound community, but mainly shows. So from an early age, even when I wasn't doing anything, we were very lucky to go and see opening nights of certain things that Scott's company were doing. So I think they've been around it from different angles all their lives. I mean, would I rather both of them were accountants? Probably. I mean,
really?
Yeah, because I know I've sat here and talked about how lucky I have been to be able to have a varied career, I think. I know how hard it is, and I know that in between the positives that we've talked about today, there was a lot of times I didn't get jobs. You know, I've worked in restaurants, I've taught, I've done various, I've like given out flyers at Ascot, I've skated in a open air cinema delivering hot dogs to people in a car park in Twickenham. I've like had to do so many other things to pay my rent in London, you know, and actually always be in the red, but just scrape through. Because my parents, by the time I left home at 19, apart from a couple of things, I really was quite self-sufficient.
But then say someone had said to you when you were 16, 17 years old, you should be an accountant, you should do that.
Forget it.
Exactly.
I
mean, yeah.
First of all, I don't have the brain power to be able to do it. I'm terrible with numbers, like really not
good.
But
if someone had said that you could have made a lot more money, you could have had a more stable life.
No, because this goes back to why I got emotional when I was told that I got that job in Starlight, because somebody just gave me a lot, like the winning lottery ticket, and I was going to get paid. Like, I would have done that for free. Like, if you'd have said to me, we want you to have this job, Sam, but when we can't give you any money for it, I would have gone, oh my God, yeah, I'm gonna chop your arm off to do that.
Mm. Yep.
But I got paid to do it. So I remember that feeling, and that's why that makes me emotional. I hope that my children have as much joy out of doing what they love at some point in their life. But I do know that they're also going to get a lot of lows, and it's how you react to those situations, and that takes quite a long time to learn. I just hope that they get as much enjoyment out of it as I have at various points in my life, but just don't take the downs and the nos too negatively when they happen, because actually that is the only way you learn.
Yeah.
When you get those no's, if you have a career where you have just hit highs constantly, at some point you will get that no, and it's going to hit you harder. So you have to build up a bit of a thick skin, I think.
Yeah. I think you're the first guest we've had on who has the perspective of a parent as well as like having done it yourself.
Mm.
So we've asked our last couple of guests for advice they would give to like younger people.
Okay.
But actually, I feel like there's a lot of parents who are listening to this podcast. What advice would you give to some of the parents of, say, the kids at the school at the moment who are absolutely loving their dance classes, their musical theatre classes, and they're going, oh, I want to do this. This is what I want to do as a job. And the parents are panicking about some of the things you've just said that you maybe worry about Molly and Joe. What would your advice be to those parents who are having those little ones going, I want to do a career that's not very stable?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I would say if your child is willing to do that and is enjoying it and loving it, you can't do anything other than be there for them. Mm-hmm. And they are going to get times where they're going to be sad and they don't get things that they want, you know, but isn't that
life?
Yeah. Mm. Not everyone is going to reach where they want to be. There's no set age or set time. It can be a quick process because of luck and where you are and who you know, or it can be a slower burn for you to get there, and both those things are fine. As long as you're enjoying it, that's all that matters.
What a lovely way to finish. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, thanks.
I think it's going to inspire a lot of people.
Yeah.
No!
Although the first guest has got slightly emotional about their journey though, which I really like.
Yeah, shows that you care so much. I mean, I'm that age where I cry if I watch an Andrex advert. No.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed that episode, everybody. As always, follow us on all our social media profiles. What is it, Rach?
What Was I Made For Pod?
Correct. On Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook.
whack@gmail.com on the end of that, and send us some stuff.
Whack. Whack it on.
Whack. Wickety whack whack.
5-star reviews. We need some more of those just to help boost us up those charts and get the algorithm working for us. So yeah, if you have time, hit that 5-star button and we'll be very, very grateful.
This is the last one without a video.
This is. Yeah, so next week will be video episodes, and also next week will be a Sean and Rach special.
Uh-oh.
We'll be answering all
what
your
if
questions.
We're not that interesting.
We'll be answering all your questions in next week's
episode.
Oh yeah,
that was good.
So yeah, look forward to that. It's very, very funny.
We think so.
We think so, yeah. Thanks again for listening, guys. We will see you again next week.
On
What Was I Made For? Peace up.
A term down. Is that copyright?
No.
What Was I Made For is a Reynolds Studios production.